Middenweg. Presentatie Ton Maas.
Goedenavond. Het komend half uur kunt u luisteren naar een gesprek met de Amerikaanse zenleraar Jeff Shore, die regelmatig ons land aandoet op uitnodiging van Zen onder de Dom in Utrecht. Begin jaren 80 vertrok Shore naar Japan om zich de zenpraktijk werkelijk eigen te maken. Aan Jacqueline Oskamp legt hij uit waarom hij nooit meer is teruggekeerd.
Jeffrey, het eerste wat ik je wil vragen is hoe je in der tijd in aanraking bent gekomen met Zen.
I was born and raised in the United States in the Philadelphia area. 1953 I was born. And in the late 60s when I was a teenager, it was the era of the hippies and yoga, Buddhism, Hinduism, all kinds of things were available there, books about these subjects. And people were talking about it. I was just a teenager then, but I was part of that generation. I hitchhiked to Woodstock when I was 15. You know, the music and arts festival, Woodstock. And I read a book when I was still in high school by D.T. Suzuki on Zen. And that already sparked my interest. I don't think that in itself would have sent me to Japan, but it certainly sparked my interest. But it was in the air then, you know, in the late 60s.
Ik ben geboren in 1953 en in mijn tienerjaren was de jaren 60 met yoga, boeddhisme, hindoeïsme, al dat soort dingen. Ik ging naar Woodstock in die jaren. Het zat in de lucht en ik las toen ook het boek van Suzuki over Zen. En dat heeft zeker iets geraakt. Het heeft niet gemaakt dat ik al naar Japan ging, maar het heeft wel iets in me losgemaakt.
As I said, I had read a book by D.T. Suzuki, but I don't think that would have been enough. But pure coincidence, in my hometown of Philadelphia, I went to a large university, Temple University. It was the only one that we could afford because my mother worked there. She was just a secretary, but that meant that her children could go tuition free. So that's why I went there. But pure coincidence, there was a disciple of D.T. Suzuki who was teaching there. He was an Italian-American, Richard DiMartino. Mm-hmm. He co-authored the book Zen Buddhism and Psychoanalysis with Suzuki and Frome. And I had already taken a course on general Buddhism, and my brother told me there was this guy named DiMartino. So you take a course on Buddhism to get a background, and then you take this course on Zen with this guy DiMartino. He'll really blow your socks off. And I went in knowing almost nothing, but this teacher, he had spent a good deal of time after the war in Japan practicing as a layman. And he had a way of just asking the simplest questions. I didn't even really know what a koan was at the time, but he would ask these very simple questions. Where do you really come from? Where are you really going? For that matter, where are we right now? And I realized I had no idea. I was already an honors student in the philosophy department, memorizing the birth dates and death dates of people like Immanuel Kant and reading the Critique of Pure Reason and trying to understand it. But I realized I don't even know who I am or where I come from. All that knowledge that I'm acquiring about people and places and dates and even philosophical theories, what does it all mean if I don't even know where I really come from, who I really am? So in a way, that teacher, it was a university course, but still, he had a way of just asking these questions that would just gently but very persuasively dig in and reveal something about you that in a way you sensed but you never saw it so clearly. And then I was stuck on Zen at that point. I couldn't get away from it even if I wanted to.
Op de Universiteit van Philadelphia kwam ik in contact met iemand die zen onderwees, Di Martino. Een Italiaan die in het naoorlogse Japan zen had gepraktiseerd. Hij confronteerde me met hele simpele vragen van wie ben je, waar kom je vandaan, waar ga je naartoe? En terwijl ik altijd gewend was geweest om heel veel kennis te verzamelen, merkte ik dat ik eigenlijk niet eens iets over mezelf wist. Dat maakte mijn belangstelling voor zen los. Toen u naar Japan vertrok, heeft u besloten om 10 jaar lang niet te praten of te schrijven over zen. Waarom was dat?
Because I had already written and spoken so much about it before then, when I didn't really know what I was talking about. What happened is I went from Philadelphia to graduate school, got a master's degree in Chinese philosophy at the University of Hawaii, then went back for postgraduate work at Temple University, where I began. And I got good, technically speaking, at writing papers about Zen enlightenment and Satori and this kind. I got the words right, and I was getting good grades. But after a while, it was almost like the papers that I was writing became a mirror, reflecting the fact that all the words are right, but you're not living it. You're not living it. And I really believed I should be, because I believed that this was the true way to be. This is the way human beings should be. I should be that way. But when I took a real good hard look, I'm not. I'm no wiser. I've learned all these things, but I'm no different. So it started to become a real existential living problem for me. So then I decided, well, just forget the study, the intellectual side. Not that that's doesn't have its value or its place, but I often say what I learned in graduate school in philosophy was that I'm not a philosopher, and a university is a great place to learn, but not the place to resolve these kinds of religious issues. So then I said, that's it, I've got to go to Japan. And if I'm going to do that, I have to stop the, pardon the expression, mental masturbations that go on, because there's a lot that you can think about, and especially I knew going to Japan was going to be a tremendous cultural difference, a challenge that way, and there would be a lot of frustrations. I knew some people that had gone, had terrible experiences, and came back and said, there's no Zen left in Japan. So I knew, if I'm going to do this, I can't go for 6 months or a year, get real frustrated, and then have a justification and come back. I'm going to have to do it. I know how stubborn I am, so 10 years seemed like a convenient time. So I said, for 10 years, I will not write or talk about it, because I've already done enough of that and, you know, just dug myself into a hole even deeper. And that was a very wise decision, because there were many times during that decade, those 10 years, where, you know, the Zen monastery is a really valuable place, but it's not a perfect institution, and it is an institution just like others. So if you start picking apart the problems that are there instead of doing the real practice, you know, oh yeah, look, the monks are back there smoking during the breaks. They shouldn't be doing that, you know. You can spend your life, or at least all your time in the monastery, picking apart the problems that you see there. And fortunately, I went when I was 28, so I was relatively old. Most of the Japanese go in right after college, so 22 years or so. So that was a very wise decision on my part, to keep my mouth shut for 10 years.
And did you find this transformation?
Yes, it took time. As I said, I was stubborn. It took some years banging my head against the wall. But I had the good fortune to find a monastery, a real Rinzai training monastery in Kyoto, where I could practice. I lived the first year more or less as a monk living in a temple and then going to the monastery for the training periods in Myoshinji. And then after that first year, I met up with Fukushima Keido. He's the head abbot of Tofukuji. Then he was the Zen master. Now he's the Zen master and the head abbot. Tofukuji, like Myoshinji, is one of the major Rinzai training monasteries in Kyoto. So through that contact and being able to practice for years and stay there, and really I had burned all my bridges, as we said. I had given up everything when I left the States. I was at the point where Paul Tillich, the Protestant theologian, says, everything is tried, nothing satisfies. So I had nothing to go back for. I knew that. And that really helped. Because if I had had anything to go back to, when the training gets really, really difficult and you really have to look at yourself, anything is better than that, you know? You know, cleaning the kitchens in some little restaurant in Saginaw, Michigan looks really good when you're really desperate.
Op de universiteit had ik prachtige papers geschreven over Zen en boeddhisme. Maar ik realiseerde me op een gegeven moment dat ik toch al die opvattingen zelf niet leefde. Dat het altijd allemaal intellectuele constructies waren. Een mentale masturbatie. Dus daarom heb ik besloten op een gegeven moment naar Japan te vertrekken om werkelijk die transformatie te zoeken. Ik heb alle schepen achter me verbrand, zodat er ook werkelijk niets was om op terug te vallen. En dat was ook belangrijk in periodes dat het echt zwaar was, want dat kloosterleven is heel hard. Dan is eigenlijk alles beter dan dat, dus zelfs een stombaantje in een restaurant. Nou ja, ik kon niet terug en ik heb die 10 jaar volgehouden en daar mijn leraar ontmoet, Fukushima. Waarom bent u gebleven in Japan?
Well, my original intention was not to leave after 10 years, but just to keep my mouth shut, just to get a real basis. And I thought, when I left to go to Japan, it's probably going to take me 15 or 20 years to really go through the practice. So I really have to make sure that I commit myself to that. But now it's now 25 years I've lived in Japan. I've gotten such a good situation in Japan teaching at a university, which is a Rinzai Zen university, that probably I'll stay there more or less, at least till I retire. There's no way that I could go back to the States and do what I'm doing now. Unfortunately, the university that I teach at has been very supportive and allows me to come a few months each year to Europe and the States. And now, actually, I'm in the beginning of a year-long sabbatical. So probably I'll stay there. The need that I had when I went is no longer there, but now it's a matter of turning around and trying to be of some help to those that were in the situation I was in 25 years ago, to in some small way be of help, because there weren't a lot of people back then who could help out and offer some, you know, concrete advice, some suggestions.
So you mean Westerners?
Yeah, yeah. Especially for yeah.
Toen ik ging had ik het idee dat ik toch wel 15 jaar nodig had om echt door die praktijk heen te gaan. Ondertussen woon ik er 25 jaar. Dat komt waarschijnlijk ook door de baan die ik heb aan de universiteit in Kyoto. Daar zal ik toch wel blijven tot aan mijn pensioen. En ik kan daar dingen doen die ik in de Verenigde Staten nooit zou kunnen doen. En verder heb ik ook een goede functie om andere mensen uit het Westen die naar Japan komen, om die van advies te dienen. De baan aan de Universiteit van Kyoto, wat moet je je daar precies bij voorstellen?
My area is international Zen. I'm able to do pretty much what I do in my life at the university, which probably the only university in the world that I can do that. So my theme is how to present Zen outside of Japan, to the West especially. So that includes translations, but also the cultural what's necessary to bring Buddhism, especially Zen Buddhism, to life in the West, not as some artificial imitation of a foreign culture, but something that comes to life in Western culture or in each and everyone's culture.
Het belangrijkste onderwerp waar ik les over geef is hoe je Zen kunt transformeren naar het Westen of welke gedaante het daar zou moeten aannemen. Dus dat betekent in de eerste plaats vertalingen van teksten, maar ook de vraag hoe Zen op een natuurlijke manier in het Westen zijn plaats zou kunnen vinden. En niet als een geforceerde imitatie van Japan. What is the most important insight you have on this field? Wat is het belangrijkste inzicht wat u op dit gebied heeft opgedaan?
I am an American and I realize that no matter how long I live in Japan, I still have at least one blue eye. Actually, some of the courses I do at Hanazono I call blue-eyed Zen. The idea is, how do I, as a blue-eyed Westerner, see and experience Zen? Because in Japan, there's not a lot of interest in Zen right now. Just like in much of the West, there's not a lot of interest in Christianity. But Japanese are very interested if Westerners are interested in something. So then they want to know, you know, because they were born and raised in it, and they've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly, just like we have with the Christian church, right? But now there's this Westerner coming and doing this. Now this piques their interest. Now they're interested, see? So what I do in Japan is very different than what I do in the West. What I do at the university in Japan is help the Japanese young people see the depth of their own religious spiritual roots, Zen Buddhism. So I call that blue-eyed Zen. But in a sense, I do the opposite when I come here to the West. The idea here is, how can we bring it to light? For example, a very simple example would be the koan. In Rinzai Zen, the koan is used in the practice. I think there's maybe a kind of a mystique about what a koan is. It's this kind of conundrum or maybe even like a mantra. And if some master gives this person a koan, somehow then they can become enlightened with it. It will work its magic or something. And that's kind of silly. If you look at the way koans actually developed, they were really no more than the burning question that had to be answered at that time, at that place, for that person. And these are what eventually came to be formulated as these koans. So I think the most important thing for the Westerner is to see that all they have to do is come up with their own living koan. Then Zen practice can really work. And then even if they have a traditional koan, if they're given one, they can start to burn with that koan. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. But people seem to have this idea that if I'm given this thing, it will work some kind of magic. And it's a bit of a naive misconception. Mm-hmm.
Een van de cursussen die ik op de universiteit geef, die heet de blauwoogige Zen, blue-eyed Zen. Dat betekent, ik ben nog altijd een Westerse man, ook al woon ik al zo lang in Japan. En het grappige is dat Japanners eigenlijk niet meer zo geïnteresseerd zijn in Zen. Dat leeft niet meer echt in die maatschappij. Maar dat een Westerling daarin geïnteresseerd is, dat vinden ze juist weer heel bijzonder. En daar zijn ze heel nieuwsgierig naar. Dus aan de universiteit in Kyoto werk ik vooral met jonge Japanners en probeer ze toch in contact te brengen met de diepte en de rijkdom van Zen, die zij een beetje kwijtgeraakt zijn. En hier in het Westen ben ik met heel andere dingen bezig. Ik probeer juist iets van die Oosterse traditie over te brengen. Bijvoorbeeld koan-studie. Over koans bestaat vaak nog het idee dat dat iets magisch is, waardoor je opeens verlicht raakt. Terwijl koans brandende vragen zijn waar je een antwoord op moet geven. Het belang is dat een Westerling leert om die vragen van binnenuit te beantwoorden. Dus binnen een Westerse context.
Well, in terms of koan practice, I think another common misconception is that through working with or struggling with the koan, someone is able to have some kind of an insight. And that certainly can and does happen. Psychological insight, or perhaps kind of a mystical insight. And that's not the original purpose of the koan in Zen Buddhism anyway. I don't believe any Zen master has a copyright on the, you know, the famous Mu Koan. Mm. People can do what they want with it. But in terms of what is done in a real monastery, a real Rinzai monastery, is, I put it just very simply, is getting to the bottom of what we call self. That's all any koan is really about, although it may go off in different directions. But first of all, we must be able to get to the very bottom of what we call ourself. Only then does the koan start to work in us. So it's really not something to bring in, initiate psychological change or transformation, although that can happen, but that's not the original purpose.
Een koanstudie is niet een manier om een psychologische verandering te bewerkstelligen, maar elke koan is bedoeld om naar de bodem van je eigen zelf te geraken en daar iets te vinden. U bent in Nederland om een serie lezingen te geven met het thema religieuze ervaring. Beschouwt u dat als iets typisch boeddhistisch?
No, I would say it's human. It has to do with being human. One example that I use in the lecture this year, which is not a koan, but it's actually from the Pali Sutras, the early so-called Theravada Buddhist Sutras. And I think it's a very good example because it's very simple and yet it's all right there. It's the story of Yasa. He was a very wealthy son of a merchant from Benares at the time of Gautama Buddha, Shakyamuni. And his father was so wealthy that Yasa, the son, was given three mansions to live in, it was said in the sutras, one for the rainy season, one for the hotter season, and one for the cooler season. So this young man was having a good life. He didn't really have to do anything. He could just enjoy himself. There were female musicians to entertain him in these mansions, and his every desire could be fulfilled. He was enjoying it. But as the story in the sutra goes, one night he happened to fall asleep while being entertained. And so all the other people in his entourage also just fell asleep. There was no need to entertain him anymore. Now, some of them still had their musical instruments in their hands. And for whatever reason, Yasa, the young man, happened to wake up while everyone was asleep now. And he looked out, and there was an oil lamp burning, so he could still see. And he describes it as being like a cemetery. Here were all these people that he had just been enjoying himself so much a few hours ago. And it was as if the veneer, the surface of existence, had been pulled away somehow, having woken up in the middle of the night and seeing it. Here were these attractive female figures. Now one of them had her legs sprawled out in a very uncomely fashion. Another one was drooling. Another one was kind of snoring a little bit. And it just struck him. He was a very sensitive young man, the sutra says. And it just struck him, having penetrated through the surface of life, you might say, and seeing this. And the way he described it, it's a little old-fashioned, the English rendering in the Pali translation. What distress indeed, what affliction indeed. You know, for myself as a young man in Philadelphia, I might have said, what a drag, major bummer, you know, really, to have seen this bad trip, you know. And having seen that, he decided, I will never return to this mansion again. It means nothing to me. He got up, walked out. It was now about sunrise. And he happened to come upon Gautama Buddha, who had just gotten up and was pacing, stretching a little bit before he would meditate. Gautama Buddha saw this young man, obviously very troubled, approaching him. So Gautama Shakyamuni sat in meditation and waited. This is India 2,500 years ago. So Yasa knew this person as a religious person. And he simply walked up, no beating around the bush, no introductions. He simply said what he had realized. Simply walked up to Gautama and said, "What affliction indeed, what distress indeed, what a drag it all is." How do you think Gautama responded to that? What could Shakyamuni say? What he said at that time, at that place, to that person was, "This is not distress. This is not affliction." And with that, Yasa was able to see there was someone who understood his problem, but also there was a way through. And so the sutras say he then removed his gold-gilded slippers and sat down and said, "Teach me." And then, not the Zen teaching of immediate awakening, but Gautama Buddha went through this gradual teaching of explaining being ethical in life and eventually what meditation was. And then he went through it. And in a very short time, according to the sutra, it says this young layman, Yasa, became an arhat, the first layman to become an arhat. Actually, at the end of that section in the Pali Sutras, it says now there were 7 arhats, meaning Gautama Buddha was the first one, and then there were the 5 ascetics that had trained with Gautama. They became awakened. And this Yasa is the very next one, and the first lay person. So in a sense, it's a very important story, but I've never seen anyone, Buddhist or Zen, take this up. But it's all right there. Here are 2 people in virtually the same place, geographically, temporally, right? And one of them is saying, "It's all a drag. It all stinks." And the other one is saying, "Nothing stinks." How can we understand that? If we take it as a koan, where is Yasa when he says, "What distress?" And where is Gautama when he says, "There is no distress"? It's very simple, but it's all right there.
Een van de verhalen die ik vertel tijdens deze lezing is het verhaal van Yasa. Het is een oud Theravada verhaal. Yasa was de zoon van een rijke koopman en hij had 3 huizen tot zijn beschikking voor alle verschillende seizoenen. En 's avonds werd hij vermaakt met dansen en muziek door een hele entourage. Op een avond valt hij in slaap en zijn hele hofhouding valt ermee ook in slaap. En midden in de nacht wordt Yasa weer wakker en ziet de aanblik van deze slapende mensen, de een snurkend, een vrouw met de benen wijd. Het is allemaal weinig verheffend. En hij zegt, wat een puinhoop is dit, wat weerzinwekkend. En hij loopt het huis uit om er nooit meer terug te keren. En dan komt hij de Boeddha tegen en zegt, wat ik nu heb gezien, wat een puinhoop was dit. En de Boeddha zegt, waarom was het een puinhoop? Het is geen puinhoop. En op dat moment besluit Yasa om leerling te worden van de Boeddha. Hij wordt een van de arhats.
U hoorde Jacqueline Oskamp in gesprek met Jeff Shore. Meer informatie over Shore vindt u op de website van Zen onder de Dom. En dat is www.zenonderdedom.nl. Op 26 mei geeft Shore een lezing in Middelburg. En meer informatie daarover vindt u op www.zeninzeeland.nl. En tot zover deze uitzending van de Boeddhistische Omroep. Die werd samengesteld door Jacqueline Oskamp. Presentatie en eindredactie Ton Maas. Techniek Wim Timmermans. Als u een van onze uitzendingen heeft gemist of meer wilt weten over onze programma's, kijkt u dan op onze website www.